Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, my name is Michael Johnston. I'm the host of New Books in Sociology, a channel on New Books Network. Today I have Dr. Sarah Halpern-Meekin, and I will be talking to her today about her book, Social Poverty, Low-Income Parents, and the Struggle for Family and Community Ties. Thank you for joining me today, Sarah.
Thanks so much for having me.
Sarah, could you start off and give us a brief introduction about who you are and how you came to write this book?
Sure. So I'm an associate professor in human development and family studies at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. I have a degree. My PhD is in sociology and social policy. So I am a sociologist, even though I'm not in a sociology department these days. And I came to this project because I study low-income families, and I study romantic relationships, and I study how families manage money. And I look at how our social policies, especially at the federal level, affect how family life goes in terms of finances and in terms of family dynamics. And so that's sort of the background that led me to doing this project.
And how would you define social poverty?
So I want us to think about the needs of people in a more comprehensive way than I think our typical focus on material necessities do. And that's what leads me to think about social poverty. So I'm not denying the fundamental importance of material needs, but I just want us to focus on the fact that people's values and motivations are more complex than a sort of dollars and cents view of them would suggest. And I think our research and policy needs to take that expansive view as well. And so that's what I'm really trying to push forward with this idea of social poverty. So social poverty is a term that I use to describe when people lack adequate relational resources. And so these are trusting relationships with family and friends that are safe and dependable, and they represent a sort of social location where people can safely disclose their vulnerabilities and they can receive acceptance and support. So social poverty is different than financial poverty in that it's inherently a subjective metric. You know, we have a federal definition of poverty, or we have the supplemental poverty measure, but social poverty is different. It's people vary in their social and emotional needs, and so how many relational partners you might need is going to differ from person to person. And then I guess I would, by way of sort of explaining the concept more fully, I would use the analogy of hunger. So hunger is a subjective feeling. We all have different caloric needs, different levels of tolerance for being hungry before we get hangry. And most of us feel hungry or lonely from time to time, some more often than others. But what sets those feelings apart from being food insecure or being socially poor is whether or not the person who's experiencing those feelings of being hungry or lonely can access the resources to meet those needs. So we're not so interested, you know, at the societal level or at the research level about my feelings of hunger if I can go home later and, you know, get something out of my refrigerator, if I have the money to go to the store and buy something to eat. similarly, we might not be so concerned about people's feelings of loneliness if they can get on the phone or go visit and see somebody who can help meet their social needs. And so I would say that people's experiences of being hungry or being lonely aren't social problems that need to be addressed through policies and programs, but being food insecure and being socially poor are. And that's because, like food insecurity, being socially poor, having prolonged exposure to unmet social needs, has harsh consequences. So it's linked to not just negative mental health outcomes, but also negative physical health outcomes, on par actually with the effects of smoking they see in some studies. And prolonged social isolation raises mortality risks. Conversely, we see that having adequate social resources is tied to better birth outcomes for moms and babies. And it's also linked to more sensitive and responsive caregiving. So these repercussions of social poverty aren't just a matter of sort of hurt feelings for now, but really can have important repercussions for people's well-being and the well-being of the next generation.
Excellent. Very well put. One of the interesting pieces that I found from the from your book is exactly that, the implications that social poverty have on financial poverty, and as well as biological implications that it has on young mothers. So now that we have a strong definition of the concept social poverty, could you talk a little bit more about your approach, your research method, and maybe your sample group that you used for this book? Because there's a lot of different ways it could be studied, but I think you took a very strong approach to understanding the stories of these young parents.
Sure. So the empirical data from this study come from a longitudinal qualitative study I did of low-income new parents who had signed up for a relationship education program, which are sometimes called marriage promotion programs. These programs have been pretty controversial. So these are government-funded programs. They got their start in the welfare reform legislation that passed in the 1990s and the Personal Responsibility and Work Opportunity Reconciliation Act. But nothing kind of happened with them in the 90s. It wasn't until the George W. Bush administration in the 2000s that these programs really took off. And academics and commentators have been pretty critical from the beginning. One called them, I think I can recall it, social engineering by the government. So there's certainly been a lack of enthusiasm for these programs. And the research on the efficacy of these programs has been sort of mixed at best. But I was really struck by the positive reaction among the participants to these programs, since that contrasted so starkly with what I'd read about them elsewhere. And so I really wanted to understand that puzzle. Why were people sort of outside these programs having such a negative view of them, while the people participating in them were really enthused about them? And so I followed 31 couples for a year, starting from when they first signed up for this relationship education program. All were unmarried at the start of the year and were expecting or had just had a baby together. All were in opposite sex partnerships. Most were in their early to mid 20s and most had a high school degree or less. Their couple income, if I sort of added together, they weren't necessarily combining finances, but if I added together to get a sense of what resources were available to this baby, I saw that they had about $1,500 a month in income when they started the program. So this generally was a group who was really struggling financially. I interviewed them both together and individually. And I did interviews at 3 points in time over the course of the year. So when they first enrolled in the program, about 3 months later, when if they had just proceeded through the program, they would have finished the main workshop component of it. And then I interviewed them again about a year after they first enrolled. And they remained in my study whether or not they participated or dropped out of the program and whether or not they broke up. In many cases, I saw a lot of changes in couples' lives over this time in terms of where they were living, whether or not they were together. They, brought babies into their households. In the case of one couple, they had two babies during the year that I that I interviewed them. So a lot of changes going on in couples' lives.
And that was something also interesting. None of the participants were married, but they were willing to have a child, but then marriage seemed to be a deal breaker. Could you tell me a little bit more about why marriage was a deal breaker at the time for many of your participants?
Well, many had a desire to marry at some point in the future, and a few actually did marry during the course of the year that I was interviewing them. I think the place to focus is not so much on why don't they marry, but why did they have a child when they weren't fully feeling ready for marriage, given that they did have a desire at some point to marry. And that's often because there's sort of ambiguous feelings or not a strong sense of planfulness or control around when you have a child. And so some of these pregnancies were in an accident. People weren't intending to get pregnant at that time. Others, people had more ambiguous feelings about pregnancy. It might be nice to have a child, but maybe not at this moment. So some people were being less conscientious about contracepting than they might have been if they had been very set against having a baby. So they were sort of rolling the dice on getting pregnant, basically. And once you get pregnant, as all the great work that Kathy Eden and Maria Kafalis have done and have shown in Promises I Can Keep, you know, it's really time to then step up to the plate. And people start looking at themselves and their relationship differently once it's not just a matter of you're sort of having this relationship, but you're starting a family. And the standards that people hold themselves and their partners to are different when a child is on the scene.
And then I also remember you pulling out some other areas of disconcert, worry that some of the participants had, and role misintegration and role overload. Did either of those pieces play a role, and why to have a child, but not necessarily to get married yet until all of their ducks were in a row, until they were fully prepared?
Well, I think it does. You know, so you're right that people are going through so many different transitions. And I think that's one of the things that was really striking to me as I was watching these couples and they were sharing their stories with me, which was so many of them were sort of doing the transition to adulthood, which means that they're not fully settled in who they are and what they want to be when they grow up. They're not fully settled with their education or with their careers. So they have a sense of still needing to sort of strive or figure things out or see the world. And they're also, you know, we know developmentally during that transition from adolescence into young adulthood, people start transferring primary attachments, first from parents to peers, then from peers to romantic partners. And so there's so many moving parts, so many transitions that are all happening at the same time. It can be really unmooring for people. And I think that's amplified for the young people I was interviewing because they're tackling two other major life transitions at the exact same time. So they're trying to become committed romantic partners and parents all as they're transitioning to adulthood. And, you know, like we were saying before, often these pregnancies are occurring before romantic ties are firmly settled. And so every aspect of life is just feeling like it's up in the air. And to top it all off, the stakes are higher than ever because the way life turns out affects not just you, but also this child whose life you want to make good. And this isn't really, you know, just a matter of people doing things when they shouldn't be prepared, but it also has to do with the context where these, you know, life transitions are taking place. So in addition to the way that lacking financial resources can complicate these transitions, we have a culture today where romantic relationships are fairly deinstitutionalized. So there aren't strong norms around the roles and rules, the social roles and rules in romantic relationships. And that makes these romantic partner transitions more opaque. So people enjoy the freedom that today's relaxed cultural norms gives them around creating their own romantic relationships to look how they want them to. But it also means that there's a lot less guidance and clarity around where people stand with one another, how they're meant to treat one another in a relationship. And that makes that sphere of life a lot more challenging to navigate or to feel like you're on firm footing, you know, or you just like two people who are hooking up and, you know, crashing together, or are you together for life just like you're married? You know, there's so much ambiguity in cohabiting situations, which is the case for many of these people. And that can make things really tricky for them. And part of that is because all of these transitions and all of this sort of lack of clarity means that it's really hard to develop trust in a relationship. So much of who you are and what you're doing is up in the air. How are you supposed to trust somebody or even yourself to act with your needs and desires in mind when those are changing and they might not even be clear yet to you? And so when you have this context that makes it difficult to develop trust, it can mean that it's really hard to be fully and consistently committed to your partner identity and to your partner behaviors when you're being pulled all different directions at the same time. Should you be acting like, you know, a 20-year-old boy is going and hanging out with his friends and drinking and partying? Or should you be at home with your girlfriend who's pregnant and expects you to be acting like a responsible family man when you're both that 20-year-old boy whose friends are out partying and about to be, you know, a father who's supposed to step up to the plate and wants to step up to the plate? So people are really pulled in a lot of directions and experiencing a lack of clarity that makes it hard to feel settled simultaneously in all of those roles.
And many of the participants declared that they felt perpetually isolated. I remember one of the young mothers saying that her responsibility is staying home and caring for the child, but she was at the age of, 18, 19 at the time, but she's like, most of these 18, 19-year-old friends who I had growing up aren't young mothers. They're going to college and doing other things. And then I remember the boyfriend saying that he felt his only role was to go to work and to bring home money that is relatively limited based on the job that he was working. I believe it was KFC, if I remember correctly, or some other fast food industry, and not bringing home much money to be able to care for the child, so therefore not feeling like he is accomplishing or fulfilling his role as father.
Yeah, so, you know, what you were speaking to with some of these parents sort of pulling away from their friend groups, that really speaks to some of these tensions that we see between the parent role and the young adult role, where the expectations of young adulthood or emerging adulthood are that you're exploring, you're trying out different selves, different activities, you're free and unencumbered by responsibility. And our cultural norms around parenthood are exactly the opposite, which is that you are going to put this child first. You, are not out partying. You are home with your kid. You are taking care of their needs first and foremost. And so what that means is that if somebody wants to adopt that parent identity and that parent role fully in a way that's consistent with our cultural norms around what parents do, it means that their lives are sort of incompatible with the lives of their friends who are living this young adult, emerging adult sort of lifestyle. And so often people would describe pulling away from their friends, and that meaning that they had less social support at this time where there were even greater role demands on them. And that really increased the stakes for these romantic partnerships, because I think the couple you were referring to, Ashley and Mark, Ashley calls Mark her best friend. And she says, if I didn't have him, I'd be the loneliest person on earth right now. And, you know, this is She's a very social person, but she and Mark have pulled away from their friends. They say there's a lot of high school drama going on among them. And Ashley says, you know, she's trying to focus on being a responsible wife and a responsible girlfriend. And being around her friends is not compatible with doing that. And so that means her social world has really shrunk, and her risk of social poverty, if something were to go wrong in her relationship with Mark, is that much higher.
And one of the interesting pieces is with this perpetual isolation, the social network shrinks. And if I remember correctly, you said that many of these participants said their social network becomes their family, potentially living with their parents or jumping from house to house, depending on which participants we are talking about. And what impact does that have on these couples you bring out in this book?
So one of the things we know from previous research, some of the social capital literature, is that there really can be a tension between getting your financial needs met through your social networks, you know, sort of getting that instrumental support, and really maintaining those relationships. So we see that it can be really stressful on people's relationships with their friends and family to be on the receiving end or on the giving end of instrumental support. And so these situations, while they do help to meet people's financial needs, can often come at a social cost, which is that they either don't feel comfortable in these relationships, or there's some stress and strain in those relationships because there are either expectations of being paid back when you can't pay back, or there are expectations of reciprocity that people are uncomfortable with, or people feel more a sense of a right to sort of assert themselves in your relationship because you're living with them or they're contributing to your well-being, your financial well-being. And so those complications of sharing households and sharing resources can actually be a source of stress for couples in the sense that they're feeling like they're not living the way they want to live. They want to stand on their own two feet. They have expectations of independence. And because it introduces this instrumental element to these social relationships that can be difficult for those relationships.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
And in some cases, some of the strategies taught within this family expectation program were not even able to be used by the participants because of their family living situation. One of the examples you provided was the timeout strategy. And in a confined living condition where there are a few rooms and you're living with several other individuals, one of the young fathers found it near impossible for him to take a time out.
Yeah, so this speaks to the ways that financial resources and social resources can really interact with each other in another way, which is that, you know, as we know, when you have fewer social resources, that means you have, fewer financial resources, it can make it harder to buy time and space for developing your relationships with people. And the example you're speaking to, I think, is a really stark illustration of that, which is there, you know, there was a couple who had two young children, and they were sharing one bedroom in his cousin's house. And when they got mad at each other, they couldn't take a breather because there wasn't a place to go where you could just cool down. They shared one room together. And so once they moved, not even onto an apartment of their own, but into the woman's grandmother's house where they had more space, it helped their relationship just because they could take a break. You know, when things got really intense, they could do the timeout that they had been taught in this relationship education program and make sure that things weren't ratcheting up when they needed to sort of steady themselves before they came back to talking with each other. And that helped them to not fight the way that they had before. And so really having this combination for them of a little bit more physical space and some of these tools that they could use helped them in their relationship.
We've talked briefly about social poverty then, and about the impact that it has on the participants in this study. Maybe now would be a good time to transition and talk a little bit about what the participants saw to be so good and so positive about these family programs that academics and maybe even some policymakers look back and said, wait, this isn't the best of program. But let's talk about a little bit about what you found from the participants when they talked about these programs.
Sure. So I think to start off with, the desire the program was speaking to was something that drew couples in, which was that they have an idea of the family life they want to live and the family life they want to provide their children with. And they're not feeling so sure that they can achieve that. So the program is offering them help with something that they really deeply value and desire, and that's achieving sort of a stable, happy family life. And a lot of these young parents didn't grow up with that themselves. And so it's something that they really want to give to their own children. A lot of men talked about growing up without a consistent father figure in the house and really wanting to do that differently for their own children. And so that focus of the program is resonating with what people are thinking about as they're, you know, preparing to welcome this child into the world. So that's the first part, is that this focus on building relationships is meaningful to couples, even couples who are really struggling financially. The second thing is that the couples really appreciated how they were treated in the program. So they felt that they were treated in a way that was really respectful and understanding and caring. They felt really cared about by the program staff. And they didn't feel judged. So, you know, I think it was a testament to a relationship education program that two of the couples who broke up during the course of the program, the moms described program staff as really helping them to have safe breakups, you know, to exit their romantic relationship safely. And these women continued talking with program staff even after they had broken up, because they were feeling like they were getting a lot of support and guidance and advice moving forward in their lives. So that's part of it, is that these relationships coming into a space where you're respected and supported was important to people and was something people appreciated. And that, you know, that respect and support is shown in a lot of ways that I think we're often kind of dismissive of when we look at how programs run. So things that we might think of as sort of unnecessary program costs are actually ways of showing participants that you respect, care about them, and are thinking about their needs. And so that can include things like just offering people a drink when they come in, you know, when they come in the door, the same way that you would if you had a guest at your house. You'd say, you want some water? Do you want some juice? Can I get you something? So treating people in that kind way is really meaningful. Giving people dinner, if you're going to ask them to show up for a program at 6, saying, come by at 5:30 first and, you know, have a bite to eat, and then we'll all sit down and do this program. Those sorts of things matter. And then the The third way I'd say that couples really saw these programs as mattering for them and why they had a positive view of them is they felt like the tools that they were being provided with in these settings resonated with the needs that they had. So a lot of couples described communication in particular as an area that was really challenging for them in their relationships, feeling like they could understand their partners and their partners could understand them, and they could communicate in ways that were successful and not damaging, that they could deal with a disagreement without it escalating to places that were uncomfortable or destructive of the relationship because people said things that in the heat of the moment that are hard to take back later. All of those things were challenges for people, and those were areas that the program really focused on. So it teaches skills, like you mentioned before, the timeout technique and other such techniques that are, you know, not unique to this program, but are a way of sort of slowing down conflict and slowing down communication to get people to focus on taking one another's perspective and actually understanding one another, and to get people to kind of take a break when they needed to, so that emotions don't get so heightened that you're just focused on winning the argument rather than solving a problem. And so all of those various forces combined to help make people feel like this program was something that was supporting and respecting them, was a place where they could come with their partner and strengthen their bond, and was giving them some hope for the future about their relationship.
And did you notice any of the participants becoming a bit skeptical when they were invited to this Family Expectations program?
So, you know, this is a program that people do voluntarily. So there's nobody being kind of forced through the door. So there's something about the program that's resonating with at least one partner in a couple that's leading them to choose to come. Some of that at the beginning can be that they offer some sort of financial incentive. So you get a little bit of what they call crib cash, which is sort of money you can spend in their on-site store to buy new baby goods. That's attractive to parents. As anyone who's a parent knows, babies have way more stuff than anybody else, and it's expensive to buy it, particularly for people who are cash strapped. You know, having the ability to get a stroller if you don't have one, or get a car seat if you don't have one, is really appealing. But a lot of the people who were at first drawn in by the financial incentives would start changing their view of the program once they saw what it had to offer beyond those financial incentives. And I certainly didn't see anyone being continuing to go to the program just because they wanted the financial incentives. If the program wasn't resonating with people, they stopped going, even with those financial incentives in place. And so there were a few people who were skeptical in the beginning, but their partners wanted to go. So a few moms described doing things like signing them up, you know, to go to the program that first day and having the cab come to pick them up, and then letting their boyfriend know, the cab's here, we're going. Well, boyfriend would say, where are we going? What's happening? They're like, you might not want to go at first, but come on, let's do it. And then once they saw what was going on at the program, they were often sort of won over that this might be something that was worthwhile.
And I think something that had to do with that was the sincerity that the workers provided, the down-to-earth atmosphere with the food, the drink, and the things like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so one participant said, you know, they're not trying to just teacher you, right? They care about you as a person. He felt like if he ran into people, you know, at Walmart or something like that, they would want to know how he was doing, and not just sort of say, how are you, but really want to know how he was doing. And so people felt like the staff cared about them. And they were under no illusions that these were like, you know, the relationships that were going to carry them through their lives. But I think the contrast between that sort of experience at an organization where you go in and the staff treats you in a kind and respectful way is often really different than what a lot of low-income people experience at in a lot of areas of their lives, whether that's, you know, the way that people get treated at their jobs or the way that they get treated when they interact with some government benefits programs. So this being a place where they're welcomed, accepted, and supported was really meaningful to people.
And I guess really to bring this to a close, what are some things that you hope people get out of this book? One of the things that I got out of it is to see that social poverty is not necessarily financial poverty. And financial poverty can be implicated or manifested through social poverty, it doesn't necessarily have to be. You gave an example of a couple who were stable in their positions, but in terms of financially, they had enough money, but social poverty still had an impact on their life. Could you talk, I guess, a little bit more about that before I guess we go into what you hope somebody to get out of this book, but maybe on how social poverty isn't financial poverty.
Sure. So I think there's been so much great work done on like social capital in general and its role in the lives of low-income individuals. And I hope that my work is sort of serving as an addition to that research, not a contradiction of it. But the approach in the social capital literature and in studies of low-income people in particular has been a view of the social ties that they have through the lens of the use value of those ties. So can you get at those financial resources you were mentioning? Can you get a loan? Can you get a job referral? Can you get a couch to crash on if you don't have someplace to stay for the night? And those are all really undoubtedly important, but they ignore the value that relationships have in and of themselves to people. So I think there's a lot that we can do to really understand the fact that people do need to meet core material needs, right? We need to have food, clothing, shelter, water, but we also have core human needs that aren't about taking care of just our physical bodies, but taking care of some of the things that make us human, which are social and emotional needs. And when those needs are not met, people will make financial sacrifices, even when they don't have financial slack to do so, in order to help meet those social needs. And what I would hope that we can see in the future is more research that's done to understand the circumstances under which people are willing to sacrifice financially to gain socially. So that can include, you know, people choosing to not ask family members or friends for badly needed financial assistance to avoid straining relationships with those people, or paying financial costs, really high costs, or collect calls, for example, when a romantic partner is in prison. So people are willing, people who don't have, you know, extra money to go around are sometimes willing to endure even more material hardship to garner some social resources or to avoid, you know, hurting their social relationships. And so that means that people are not just acting to maximize their financial well-being, but they also have these competing social needs. Sometimes those might be compatible with their financial needs, and sometimes they might not be. And I think we want to take a more holistic view of people and understand when those social needs sort of win out. When and why are people willing to make financial sacrifices to sort of gain these social resources for themselves to avoid social poverty?
I think that would be a definite thing that I got out of this, and that many readers, I hope, get out of this book. Financial stability, financial ability to sustain life is important just as much as social stability and integration within these communities of people. Mm-hmm. Is also important. going into other books like Durkheim's Suicide and Social Integration and the significance that it has for people. That's something that I might relate to this book. But yes, thank you for writing this, and thank you for starting the conversation. So what are you working on now?
Well, I have two qualitative projects underway. I'll tell you about each briefly, and I'm unsure of the ways that social poverty may emerge. It sort of seems to be the thing that once I started thinking about social poverty, I started seeing it everywhere. But we'll see how it emerges in these two other projects. So one is a study of prime age men who are between the ages of 25 and 54 who are not in the formal labor market. We know that labor force participation rates for prime age men have been declining for decades. And that's sort of been masked by the fact that until fairly recently, women's labor force participation rates were rising. And so, you know, we had a lot of people in the labor market still, but that's no longer the case. And so we have more and more men who traditionally would have been in the formal labor market who aren't. And economists have been doing some, you know, good work studying why that's happening. But I really wanted to make sure that we have the voices and perspectives of the men themselves in that discussion. And so we've been doing interviews with men who are out of the labor market, who are living in rural Wisconsin, to understand how they make meaning in their lives, what activities they do, how they make ends meet, those sorts of things. So that's one project I'm continuing to work on now. And the second that I'll mention is there's an income support experiment that's going on where poor mothers are being given unconditional cash gifts. Either small gifts of $20 a month or larger gifts of $333 a month from the month that their babies are born. This is called the Baby's First Years project. And I am lucky enough to be able to do a qualitative sub-study of that project. So their research team will be tracking, you know, children's outcomes and those sorts of things. But I'm going to get the opportunity to lead a research team who's interviewing a group of the moms who are participating and to find out what it's like for them to be getting this extra money, how they think about allocating that money, and how they see their lives unfolding given the financial resources that they have and the financial decisions that they're able to make with this additional gift money.
Wow, these both sound like very exciting research topics, research projects. What form do you see them being written up in? Is it going to be a book? Are they going to be books?
It's very hard to say in advance, you know, with these qualitative projects that are inductive, you just don't know what you're going to find and what the story is going to be. So I certainly didn't know, you know, before I started collecting data for the Social Poverty Project that would turn into the book that it is, because I didn't even have these ideas about social poverty yet. So I'm excited to see what new ideas I learn about from the people I'm talking to.
Well, thank you again for joining us on New Books in Sociology. Again, my name is Michael Johnston, and this is New Books in Sociology, a channel on New Books Network. Look forward to talking to you soon, Sarah, and thank you for joining me today.
Thanks so much, Michael.